Welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast, episode 17. My name is Greg Martin, and I have chosen to dedicate my life to my own business, and I'm currently the CEO of a food company in Toronto called Farmer Prepared Meals. In my spare time, I record this podcast where I like to explore other people and their careers. I talk to people from all backgrounds about their jobs and why they do them. For you, it's a chance to meet different people, and if I'm doing my job right, who knows, their stories may inspire your life or your future career in some way. In this episode, we're talking to a climate change activist who now runs a farm and owns a brewery. And it's clearly an interesting conversation, so let's hit the intro music and get going. If you're a fan of this podcast, you can go to lifetimeatwork.com and keep up with me. You can also follow me on Instagram. I'm gregmartin.work. And I would also love a review. If you could go to Apple Podcasts, it's probably the best place to do it, and leave a review on there of any kind. It helps more people discover the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Farmer Prepared Meals. It's the prepared meals company that I own, and we are delivering more and more places around Ontario. They are very easy, convenient meals. You just heat up and go. They're made from scratch by our real chefs, and we use as good of ingredients as we can find. We try to source locally. Anyways, it's great food. So just go to farmr.ca, and we can likely deliver to you every week, depending on where you are. And if you use the promo code IKNOWGREG, all one word, you'll get a bit of a discount. As you may or may not know, in 2017, I invested with a group of people into a restaurant called Farmer. And the idea was it was a casual farm-to-table place, but we were working with a lot of local producers, farmers, just interesting people doing interesting things, very locally, community-based, and trying to bring that experience and that food to downtown Toronto in the city by the St. Lawrence Market. And that was kind of the idea of the whole concept that we wanted to do was, hey, let's call it Farmer. Let's have a connection to farms and make it about that. So even though Farmer in its old form has been upended by COVID-19 and we are now doing prepared meals, the old business of Farmer and the restaurant, the farm-to-table restaurant, and sometimes we'd find a business and it would just dawn on us, oh man, this is crazy. This is a cool business. I'm surprised it exists. You wouldn't think it would. And I think it's just part of knowing the business world, or you think you kind of know about what's out there. And then when you find something new, you're excited about it and you want to try it and you want to support it and you want it to succeed. And so when our head chef, Kyle Webster, when he found this brewery called Good Lot up in Caledon, it was really a different brewery than I'd ever really come across. It wasn't so much about the pure branding and trying to be some flashy beer brand. It was a hop farm. They were growing their own beer. They were growing the ingredients to make their own beer. And I thought that was really cool. And over the years, we've kind of got to know Good Lot Brewery more and more. The people that run it, Phil Winters, who I have on here, he runs the business with his wife, are just really interesting. Phil, who I have on the podcast today, has a background as a climate change activist. He lived in Denver for about 10 years and did all these things to try to save the environment, including getting heavily involved in the solar industry to try to make it successful. And he, as he got older and kind of left that industry, he then became a farmer. And so is an interesting kind of story of how you can kind of go from one thing to another, but really all the while trying to make a difference and have an impact and have a belief that you then can work towards making the world better in a different way. And it might sound kind of weird. How is a brewery and farming and being a hop grower going to make the environment better or help the world? But that's what the conversation's all about. That's why you're listening. So a few things I'll mention at the outset. We are drinking during the episode. Phil was nice enough to send me some samples of Good Lot, a few of the ones that I haven't tried. They make a lot of different beers all the time, so it's always cool to get a few new ones and a few samples sent. And even if you're not overly into beer, I think you'll still find it beneficial because we talk a lot about kind of farming and the local food movement and just the beer industry more generally. And it's an interesting one. because they've chosen to get into the beer industry, which is dominated by some really big companies, some really big corporations with a lot of money and a lot of power. And it's just, it's hard to make a dent. And so we get into that and the challenges that he faces and the challenges I think Phil and his wife and just in trying to do what they're doing now have been facing all along. So here's my interview with Phil Winters. So Phil, welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, why don't you, I find it works best if you just begin with telling people who you are. So maybe just if you can give sort of 2 or 3 minutes, the very quick highlights on who you are, and we'll go from there.
Well, thank you. So my name is Phil Winters. I live up in Caledon, Ontario with my wife and my son. And we collectively work at Good Lot Farm and Farmstead Brewing up here, making what we call hyper-local farm-raised beer. We've been up here for pushing 12 years now and running an organic farm for 11 of those years, which focuses primarily on hop production for local craft beer consumers and producers. And then that became a brewery about 3 years ago. And I'm from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, proudly, and went to Queen's University and lived in Denver, Colorado for 10 years and out west in Canada for a couple of years, and then wound up back in Southern Ontario.
Okay. So did you just go and decide that you wanted a farm, or how did you just get into, hey, hop farming is interesting, I'm going to do that?
Great question. I mean, it was a long process. I mean, my career arc was really as activist, and that always led to hanging out with a lot of people who are into organic farming, who were growing food, which led me to start growing food and flowers and things, you know, when I bought my first house, I guess, a long time ago.
Yeah.
In Denver. And really appreciated that aspect of, you know, it was a hobby completely at that point while I was working in either political campaigning or renewable energy sectors. And, you know, when I came back to Ontario, I loved Toronto. I went to high school in Toronto and 2 years of grade school there as well, and called it home for a long time. But I did not want to live in the big city anymore. And my wife and I, Gail Winters, Gail Goldsack formerly, she and I, you know, we'd dream about, and living in downtown Toronto, but we're going to move in 3 years to the country to go farm. What we didn't know. It was this grand romance, and as we call it, sort of running off in high spirits. And Gail was born and raised in Caledon, Ontario, where I'd really never been except to drive through, I guess, on Highway 10. And we came up here one of the first times we went out looking and found this amazing old heritage farm here and just decided, let's do it now instead of waiting 3 years, and our life will and our careers will get dragged along with us. We don't know what those are. We were both really tethered to Toronto at that point, and both commuted at the very, you know, beginning, and we were having a baby, which was the other impetus for us to get out of downtown Toronto. As much as we love the city, was to raise our kid out in the country, and that led us to buying a farm without really knowing what we were going to farm. It took us a while, lots of research, to determine that, you know, specialty crops are what we do. It's a smaller farm. It's only 27 acres, but it's got beautiful soil. And through our research, hops kept rising to the surface as a specialty crop at the time. This is 2009, winter to 2010, that there was a shortage of hops globally at that point because of warehouse fires and bad seasons. And there was a huge surge in demand and for hops, especially aromatic aroma hops, what we call, that were being put into IPAs as the IPA craze began in the States particularly.
Right.
You know, Canada's sort of 10 years behind the States in the craft beer evolution. And so Gail and I started training as hop farmers and working the soil, learning everything we could, banded together with anyone we could find. And so it was this long, you know, career arc to get to that point where we settled on, we're going to grow hops for the industry. And went around to different breweries that we liked, you know, we were drinking at the time, saying, what are you putting into your beer? We're going to grow hops for you. Found the varietals and then started from there.
Okay. And so then it was years later where you said, we want to expand and open up a brewery ourselves.
So vertically integrate, we sort of called it, you know, value added farming practices. You know, so we're an organic hop farm. Organic hops are extremely hard to grow, especially in Ontario. If you ask the specialty crop people at the, you know, the Ontario Ministry of Ag that we work with, they tell you that, you know, trying to grow hops organically in this climate is probably the most difficult specialty crop in the province. So it is a massive, laborious, you know, especially at our scale, because we're only at 2.5 acres of hops at this point. We can't really mechanize in large scale, so we have to use human labor primarily, which is good because it is lower carbon ultimately. And it was very difficult to make money. And, you know, we started having some success and good seasons and selling to, you know, Granite and Wellington doing specialty stuff. But it's such an unknown, you know, in terms of a specialty crop that's so sensitive to pests and disease. You know, the vast majority of hop farmers use intensive chemical herbicide, you know, compounds on their soil, which we refuse to do. That's the only way they can really guarantee success on an annual basis. And so we started looking, what's the natural progression of what we're doing here? And we really started to get into the terroir aspects of, you know, hops. Ontario hops, is, you know, and this research has been advanced since we started thinking about this, are distinct to, you know, a Cascade that's grown in the Pacific Northwest, primarily where Cascade hops, super popular hop, come from. Ontario has its own properties, and people are into the wine industry, you know, understand those spider charts of flavors, that there's a distinct compound in our soil that's creating these flavors. And so let's try to create beers that, you know, embody and encapsulate those differences to really make like Ontario beers. And that was motivating because we love the farm to table movement. We love the chefs we were working with, you know, eating with, dining at. And we thought like that needs to extend everywhere because that's great for the environment. It lowers transportation distances for food. Craft beer movement was growing. We thought, you know, let's start just trying to make some beers that really are the elements of our farm, our soil, this region, and see if that's distinct, you know, based on water, what we're growing and things of that nature.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll get into kind of a lot about kind of the beer industry and sort of your place in it, like your past and how it then brought you to one, I think, wanting to do something like this, but then also just knowing enough or feeling like you knew enough to venture into being a farmer. Cause when I look at your past, it's not very obvious that it's like, oh yeah, that's yeah, where he's headed or what you did. It was a lot of, like you said, you know, in the energy and renewable space and, you know, environmentally conscious, probably more corporate. I guess, what did you take away from all the stuff that you had done sort of in the past, and were there kind of key highlights of your past career that you sort of used here, I guess, to inspire you maybe to do what you're doing now?
If I go back, you know, to the beginning, I came out of university and I was a super rad environmentalist all my time outside, loved tree planting, et cetera, et cetera. I moved to Colorado to go and pursue mountains and slot canyons and things of that nature. And as soon as I got there, the first job I got, I didn't have a lot of intention beyond just exploring the landscape of the Southwestern United States. Because I had a green card at the time. I thought, I'm going to go somewhere I don't know a single person in the world. I'm going to go and, you know, had a great high school and university and everything else. Let's go and have this adventure. Not too far. I mean, Denver's not very far from home, but. Yeah. And I wound up with this band of, you know, crazy environmentalists in my first job there, which was going to be temporary while I looked for a permanent job working for an organization called Clean Water Action, which was primarily knocking on people's doors, talking about local water issues or the Clean Water Act federally, trying to get them to write letters, become members, so we'd have a lobby force, and then, and that was my job. It was a huge education, going to the States and seeing the impact of big money on politics and how the environment was just never any of the top 10 layers of consideration in building policy in the States. And I started to translate that to Canada, and I thought, how naive I've been. I thought, I didn't know it was so corrupt, you know? And so I really dedicated myself at that point, like, I'm going to be an activist my whole life. Like, the world doesn't need more corporate raiders, doesn't need more successful CEOs. It needs, you know, activists who are going to try and fight and educate and, you know, fight to, and climate change became that issue really early on. Back in like 1997, I got hired for my first climate change campaign to organize at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And through that process, really educated myself about what, you know, at the time we referred to as global warming, I'm like, well, this is the issue of the century, and I got to work on this for the rest of my life. And so I kept doing that. And that got frustrating after a while, because you think, like, I remember one campaign in particular. We were fighting in this beautiful mountain valley in the middle of Colorado. And we went around and organized the town. We were hired by a group of concerned citizens who were, you know, leading rafting trips primarily in this canyon, in this valley. And they hired us to come in and organize. And we got a letter from almost every single citizen of that county and presented it to the county commissioners, who got to make that decision and still voted to allow the quarry to go through, despite the fact that every stakeholder, landholder that lived there told them they shouldn't do this as their elected officials. Well, too late, you voted us in. We've been paid off. This is how we interpreted it at the time, and I still would. You know, we've already been paid off, so, you know, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So I got frustrated with the political, and I thought, well, then maybe we need to be making sure politicians are getting elected who are going to be incorruptible, who are going to, you know, not stand for this kind of shit. So I kind of pivoted from, you know, pure activism running in nonprofits to being more engaged in the political process of getting people elected. And so I ran a bunch of campaigns that were nonpartisan, but always trying to exemplify, here's the environmental issues at stake in this election. Make sure you're registered, make sure you're educated, make sure you vote. And that was awesome for a really long time, until my last campaign in the States, which was for the Denver mayor's race. And I remember going into this big business crowd, because the guy we were supporting, who became the mayor and then the governor and is now U.S. Senator, actually, John Hickenlooper. And we had a fundraiser at his loft, and the whole campaign staff, we were all treated like butlers, waiters and waitresses. And I thought, oh, so these are the guys with all the power. So, you know, they're the decision makers. So we got to make sure we can speak to them and speak their language. And so I decided, well, I'm going to go work in the renewable energy space, because that's climate change campaigning had made me realize that solar power was absolutely the solution to the future, you know, of this planet. And why is that not being deployed? And there was nobody doing it at all at that point. It was super expensive. It was all very grassroots, what we call guerrilla solar. You'd go out and install 4 solar panels without any permits and connected to the grid, knowing you were offsetting some coal-fired electrons, you know, back then.
Yeah.
This very sort of Edward Abbey, Monkey Wrench Gang sort of stuff. And then, so I went to work for Sustainable Energy Technologies. You know, I left the world of politics in the States and moved back to Canada, because I wanted to be in Canada anyway, and went to work with Sustainable, now Iguana Technologies. And that's how I got into the business world. And I stayed in that, you know, as an activist. I wanted solar to be a primary source of energy. And so I worked as an activist in the business world for a long time to do that, until that got super boring, because it got taken over by, no offense, you know, Greg, investment bankers. In the sense that, and I very distinctly remember the conference in Dallas, you know, it was the American Energy Association or solar conference. At the time, there were probably still only, you know, 25 people in Canada that were really involved in the solar industry at this point. And all the guys, you know, I see the same guys at these conferences every year in Canada and in the States. And we all looked around and we're like, well, who are all these guys in suits? You know, we couldn't figure out, because we had been a fairly hippie dominated sort of industry. And all of a sudden the investment bankers figured out, you know, this is a really good 25-year warranties, no maintenance, solid state technology, nothing to break down. It powers everything in outer space. And so the solar industry took off, because it became a very, you know, secure, fundable, securable investment. And that I got out at that point, because it was so corporate and trying to figure out a different way to become an activist. And so the farming became foremost in what I wanted to do, and found an amazing partner that Gail also wanted and was ready to leave the film industry, where she had a successful career, and pursue this farming endeavor.
Yeah, they make us wear suits.
Not anymore. Not anymore. Become very casual.
Less so now. We're sure, try to blend in, I think. But don't you think that for the movement, to some degree, you need more buy-in, more acceptance, more for solar or for any technology? You need the focus of lots of different stakeholders and people and organizations and whatever to really make it work?
For sure. Yeah. 100%. The investment bankers becoming part of the solar industry is what has made solar mainstream. And that's part of the reason I could leave the industry. I felt like my activism here is done. Yeah. You know, we've achieved our goal. It's totally mainstream. Like, this is going to take over the world, which it is. I mean, it is fastest growing form of energy on the planet. And the price is, you know, basically on par with what we pay on the grid today in Ontario. So why wouldn't you use this? It's intermittent. So now you have the battery technology where the price is coming down dramatically. No, investment bankers and, you know, the combination of debt and equity that came into that space was the critical piece of the puzzle to make it grow so that we could shut down a bunch of coal-fired plants in Ontario so we could stop having so many smog days in downtown Toronto, for instance.
Yeah. So how did you then sort of translate that all then into kind of what you're doing now and Goodlot and farming? I mean, what is kind of the grand, hey, I'm trying to change this about local and farming, and I you know, I have lots of ideas myself on that, but I'm curious to see and you know, your take on the impact that you can have and where, yeah, I guess you know, mimicking that impact from the past in your career and more recently, say, in solar, how, you know, what is that as it relates to farming and the beer industry?
Yeah, so you know, it's like what Yvon Chouinard and the folks at Patagonia say, like, we're in business to save our home planet. The only thing to me that's interesting in business is to try, or, you know, just in life, is to try and demonstrate here is a sustainable path forward. You know, most people, I think, can see clearly that we haven't, you know, attended to all the right attributes of how we make decisions in terms of how we all live on this planet, you know, in a healthy, positive way for many, many more millennia, ideally. And so farming is that representation for us, and especially the way it starts to encompass manufacturing of beer, is how do we demonstrate a business practice that demonstrates the evolution of that business? It's like like the energy industry, you know, the energy company, Hydro One or whomever the generators are. You know, coal was cheap and easy, and we'll just go get it, and it'll come here on a rail car, and we'll burn it, no problem. And then as time evolves, they realize, well, that's not the practice that's going to work, because look, downtown Toronto is choking on smog, so we need to pivot, you know, over to wind turbines and to PV and storage and whatever. And so Gail and I are just so interested, because there's this whole evolution happening in the farming industry right now as well, especially with regenerative agricultural practice. We've always been an organic farm, but take it to this deeper level where you're really, you know, dealing with the biome of the soil, and healthy soil is everything. And diseases that are so innate in the hop plant here in Ontario particularly, you know, we had to rely on the health of the root system and the plant itself to provide the strength for, yep, that pest is going to come through the yard at some point in the year, but the plants are strong enough to be resilient enough to still flower and provide a really high quality alpha and beta acid in the final product, the hop that we're trying to use, you know, in our beers.
I feel like it's a challenging thing to go up against. There's just the money, I guess, of and the distribution and all that of these big beer companies. And it seems daunting to me.
Well, it is. I mean, they break the law all the time, right? They're literally, you know, anti-corruption laws around the distribution of beer, not inducing people to keep, you know, to have your beer. But there's all sorts of ways around that. So you can't really compete with the Molson and the Labatt, and, you know, the AB InBev and, you know, SAB. They go and pay for an entire, it's really hard for a restaurant like Farmer, for instance, or any other restaurant who cares, because, you know, much like beer, it's the restaurant industry, it's a slog. You got to fight every day to get the greatest food, greatest ingredient, keep your staff happy, keep your patrons happy, and try to make a marginal margin on it so that you can actually pay yourself at the end of the day and continue to push whatever movement is you're trying to push out of that space. And beer is the same. But you're additionally up against multi-billion-dollar companies that will put in an entire new tap line for you. So for a small restaurant that's budget is stretched, I mean, I know at building a brewery, like, you're cutting corners every once in a while, like, I just, no more of that. I can't afford that $2,000 right now. Oh, I'll just build you a whole new tap line and give you a nice tower, and I'll give you your beer half price for the first year. It's easy for a restaurant owner to take that offer because, well, I mean, that's they want to survive. They want to be able to get to that place And maybe in their mind, they're thinking, well, I can compromise this right now to get to that place of no compromise. But if you compromise day one, you're never going to get to the no compromise zone. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of people that you can't sell beer to because they're betrothed to giant corporations. But more and more, there's a value set I see in all industries. And I think, again, coming out of this COVID pandemic, that people are more focused on, you know, local quality, nutrition, the things that I think will make, you know, communities in Toronto and Markham and Caledon and Orangeville and Barrie all thrive, is people are going to look a bit more inward and be more satisfied with what they've got around them and support those great locations that they have. But yeah, it's sort of like going up against the mafia, you know, in large part in the beer industry. Yeah. It's not, I mean, I guess, I don't know if it feels the same for you, you know, with having McDonald's and Harvey's and Burger King, you know, all over the place or whatever other, you know, giant conglomerates of restaurants there are. But how they induce, you know, people or landlords to not let you go in there, or whatever it is they do to try and fight you to keep their market share like the beer companies do.
Yeah, you know what? To a certain extent, I think people do seek out places that are, like, as far as restaurant goes, like that are unique and different. And I think the ones that are doing it properly, you know, can succeed. It just is very challenging from a just volume perspective, right? Of trying to get really, and I think beer is probably the same thing. Yeah. I mean, the food industry, you realize when you're in it, like, that it's really comes down to, hey, can you actually have enough volume to sort of make this all work? And some, you end up getting limited by the capacity of your dining room and how much your kitchen can produce and all these things. You know, as much as you're trying to do things right, and the better way, then it just becomes challenging to kind of do it all. And I think with food, it's less about the big guys and it's more just about the dealing with landlords and just all the various stakeholders and everything that there's a lot of it. It's a complex. Yeah.
For sure.
Do you see that? I mean, you spent some time in the US and mentioned that the beer industry is sort of well advanced there. So where are we going to be in 10 years? What do you think is happening there that will probably end up, you know, impacting and influencing where we go?
Oh, light lagers and pilsners. Everyone's going to go back to light lagers and pilsners. Like, oh, this is what we were drinking before. It's like Molson and Labatt. Yeah. Oh, I actually, honestly, I can't even answer that question, Greg. I don't really know. Like, I'm hoping that from an environmental and local sourcing standpoint, we'll be way advanced, especially in Ontario. I can't really look beyond Ontario. There's been a movement in the States of big breweries, the big corporates buying up the distribution networks of all these other breweries, you know, that could occur in Ontario over the next 10 years. And there's been a little bit of that with Mill Street, obviously being consumed by Labatt. But I hope not, unless, you know, there's some upside to that happening, which I don't really see. I don't know. I mean, the flavor profiles, you know, everything waxes and wanes, and the flavor profiles, you know, right now we're in the midst of big, dank, juicy New England IPAs, you know, and that movement has been afoot for at least 18 months, if not 2 to 3 years. And some people might laugh at me for not knowing better, but, you know, like, it looks like, or I remember someone coming to me, another hop grower, it's like, do you like NIPAs? Like, well, I don't even really know what a NIPA is. You know, I'm selling my hops over to Muskoka and they don't make a NIPA. What's a NIPA? Oh, it looks like orange juice. You know, I was like, orange juice. Well, that sounds horrible. And of course, wasn't that long after that I you know, started to see New England IPAs and these big, dank, you know, almost gray looking beers and drinking them and thinking, oh, these are super delicious. I mean, maybe a little bit too much, but super delicious. But they were all based on Mosaic, Citra, all these, you know, hops from either Australia, you know, Western US or New Zealand. And none of it was benefiting Ontario. None of it was trying to, you know, bring these flavors of Ontario out. So I'm hoping that we'll see more and more of that. Because again, I think Ontario has this great opportunity to really distinguish, you know, a terroir sense of, you go to Ontario because the beer there is so good and it's so unique because they really partner with their local farmers as much as possible. And, you know, that would be very interesting to see just because it's great for everybody ultimately, I think. But who knows? I mean, who knows where the beer industry is going to go? I've been really amazed. I mean, I guess beer is somewhat pandemic proof, which the restaurant industry didn't prove to be quite as much. That all the breweries have really, you know, thrived through this. You know, I was terrified, like I have been for the, you know, the food and bev and like food and bev industry generally, like, oh my God, the restaurants, like all these people have put their hearts and souls into these endeavors, you know, and it's, they're being crushed right now. Same way I think about, you know, people who are artists, actors, musicians, and maybe moonlight as a bartender or a waiter or waitress and thinking, man, like everything that they're doing right now has been crushed. Yeah. How are they surviving and getting through this? So you got to be so resilient. And beer has proven to be really resilient because alcohol has been increasingly important through the pandemic, like caffeine and pajamas and track pants and all the things, the charts you see. And people have been drinking more for sure through this. But, you know, the communities have really rallied around it. And it kind of goes back to what you asked earlier. You know, the success of most breweries and differentiating, there's, you know, the whole that Budweiser buying $100 million of ads, it's like it's half brand, it's half taste. Now, you can make really shitty beer but have an amazing brand and survive. And you can make amazing beer and have a crappy brand and generally survive. But if you can find some balance between the two, you know, you're likely to succeed, you know, more that way. And, but communities are really what support their local breweries, regardless of the brand and almost regardless of, you know, bad beer. If it's consistently bad, they're not going to be supported or survive. But the local community is that's your local fortress of people who they want you to be there because they like that they have a brewery. They like that there's a space to go and hang out with their neighbors and, you know, who are like-minded, who enjoy local beer and craft beer and are evolving into that industry. And that's what's helped everybody survive, you know, this last year particularly.
And there's a positive story, I think, of when you've got something in the neighborhood. Like I think people to a certain extent, yeah, definitely do want that place that's close that they can go to that is, hey, it came, there's a story behind it. Whereas it's hard to say like, oh, I bought Budweiser and here's the story and here's what, you know. Yeah. buy it because I got my first one when I was 12 and now I just never stop. Yeah. You know, it's like that's not, it's not quite the story.
Clydesdales and
we want the story of like hey, this was started by this, you know, this guy trying to do this and it was local to the community and they're doing this with their hops and they're making this type of beer, etc. Like that's cool. And you know, my impression of the US is that they spend a lot of the craft beer movement anyways is a lot of creativity. There's a lot of different things, I think, which was what your point was from before, which is, hey, they're really being inventive, throwing things into beers that you never would otherwise think about. And it's just, hey, let's see what it's like. And people can tell us whether they like it or not, and maybe we'll strike gold. But let's just be creative with it. And why not? And I think that ideally would be something with any food, right? Like that's a cool way versus the, you know, hey, this is a 400-year, it's one strategy, but like, hey, this is a 400-year-old beer that's never changed and it's been always the same. And that's something different. But you know, it may be a bit more exciting to have something that changes every once in a while and can be unique. How do you guys approach it then in terms of, and you sent me some beer samples and maybe I'll give you now the opportunity to mention them. But in terms of, you know, you mentioned it a few times in terms of, hey, Ontario being ideal for a certain hop profile and a flavor profile and whatever, what is that? And what is the ideal, say, Ontario beer and the hops that are here that work just really well?
So my favorite beers in Ontario are wet hop beers, and I'm kind of weird that way, I guess. But you know, we make beers every year, and some others do. And Nickelbrook used to make the best one. They haven't done it for a couple of years, but Nickelbrook. I mean, I used to chase this beer to every LCBO, and if there were 30 bottles on the shelf, I'd buy 28 and leave two. And like, I want two more people to get into this. The hops come straight off the binds, and they go straight into the kettle. then you get a totally different, unique flavor profile off the hop in that circumstance, because normally hops are dried and crushed and pelletized and preserved, and then that's how they're induced into the beer as pellets, and they dissolve because they're, you know, in powder form. And you lose certain qualities along the way of picking, drying, smashing and processing. Whereas you get this raw ingredient off the vine, and the beauty of Ontario, again, or anywhere where there is a proliferation of hop farms, is that you've got a hop farm close enough to the brewery to do that, because hops deteriorate very quickly once they've been picked. They're a fresh flower. And So it's really unique and special that you can do these wet hop beers. So our high fives this year, Mike Brooks is our head brewer now, and he's just like a fucking genius. And it's the best. I mean, I keep saying it's just as good as Nickel Brooks. This is just as good as Nickel Brooks, because they were just so enamored with that beer.
Yeah.
So enamored with that beer. But I've lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
But in terms of like the beer that works well for Ontario, you talked about it at the beginning or earlier, just saying, hey, people are going to come to Ontario and say, I'm going to come for this and whatever. And so what would be, in Denver, what would they say? Like, oh, this Ontario, like, because of this Ontario beer is the hottest.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have an answer. There's a water profile aspect, but our water profiles are different across the whole province. But when you think of beer style specifically, you know, to a region, you know, like a Pilsner coming out of that region of the Czechoslovakia, because it had this super, super soft, easy water that made great Pilsners, and everybody tries to emulate that style of beer on a global level. But that came out of that, you know, Pilsner region of the Czech Republic, much like, you know, IPAs came out of these regions with hard water, and, you know, hard water profile. And that is how the hops sort of resonated in those beers. And that dynamic created a flavor that people try to emulate around the world. We haven't found it in Ontario yet, you know, but I do believe it's there. But you have to be, those styles of beer that we chase are water profile based as much as anything, but it was also, that was local grains, local hops. I mean, it was all local product going into those beers that created these great styles that, you know, people would find, taste, and say, go home and like, I've got to make that same beer. And that's how Pilsners and IPAs are such global phenomenons. I don't know what Ontario's is. You know, someone's going to hit it. I'm sure maybe they already have, and I just haven't tried it. There are so many amazing breweries in Ontario right now. I mean, so creative, making really consistent, beautiful beers. And there's so many that are sort of coming up in that as well. As people put in new breweries, get used to their equipment, get used to their adjuncts, get used to their team and everything else that are coming. So I have no fear that Ontario is going to, you know, really resonate on the map of beer. Quebec has got a really great strong profile in the global, you know, beer world, as BC has a developing one. I guess Alberta to some extent, but I think Ontario can really be this great, you know, beer centric and cider simultaneously. We're a great cider province because of the apples we have. I mean, that's what drives the cider industry here. We are an amazing apple growing region. We grow amazing apples, maybe some of the best apples in the world. Well, that drives cider. That's a very much more direct, you know, single sort of adjunct relationship. But I do think we have that opportunity in the beer world. And again, there's so many great breweries that are, I do believe, pursuing that, and with, you know, integrity and great intentions. So it's just a great time to be a beer drinker in Ontario, particularly.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's lots of options. Sometimes it can be harder to get it to a certain, in some ways, depending on where you go to buy your beer. But when you think locally and you think about, hey, you know, where can I drive to, and the beer lasts. And so sometimes when I, you know, you just find yourself driving around to somewhere else and you kind of have to think about, hey, oh, I'm going by this brewery. Okay, I can buy this now and stock up on this one and drink this for a while. and then when I'm driving somewhere, and it's kind of how I think, you know, I don't go to Caledon very often, but if I do, then okay, then, you know, it can make sense to stop by and check out the brewery and then take some home. And that's a cool way, I think, of seeing where you live and also being able to, I think, take something back and take something home, which you can't do in a restaurant per se the same way. But you kind of can with beer.
Well, you can with food. I mean, too. I mean, you could go, I mean, people go to Tuscany to, you know, hit wineries, but also there's a series of restaurants they want to go to. And, you know, I'm going to plug Caledon and say that, you know, when you do, and please bring Chef Kyle with you when you come, like there are, you know, great cideries.
Yeah,
and great breweries in this region, you know, Badlands and Sonnen Hill and Caledon Hills and Goodlot. You know, there's four breweries in this one region. I mean, it's a reason to come and visit, and it makes people feel good. It's the reason people go to around to do these things. And you can layer on top of that, there's amazing culinary destinations in this region too. And it's much the same in Niagara, Prince Edward County, lots of other regions of Ontario. So I think it's very worthwhile, you know, especially these days when you can't really go too far away. What a great way to have an experience and to get out of your house and to go and experience your local. I mean, I feel very strongly that the next couple of years are going to see a huge increase in people jumping in their cars for the day or for a night or two and just exploring that local region and reconnecting with the beauty of what's right at your doorstep and appreciating, much like we all do our family members more now than ever, probably because we've been stuck with them, but appreciating like what is really at your doorstep and not always thinking, well, I really got to go see Egypt. I really got to go see South America, which I want to see all those things, but you know, not without understanding like how beautiful where you live right now all is and appreciating, you know, the here and the now and what is, you know, what we have. So.
Yeah. Is your biggest seller, which one is that, the Farmstead Ale or?
Farmstead Ale is definitely our number one just because it's been out there the longest and has the, you know, biggest fan base and is in the biggest distribution channels. You know, it's in more LCBOs and grocery stores than any of our other beers. Most of the beer we sell is here on site. That's very small volumes, I guess, ultimately compared to Farmstead Ale.
And so if you were to say then what you're trying to go for with the rest of the lineup and how often in a year, like how many different beers would you guys make?
Well, our pace right now is 52. I think we probably made about 30 different beers last year.
Yeah.
But we have been releasing a new distinct release on a weekly basis for the past 6 months straight. I think we've missed one weekend. And that is in large part due to Mike Brooks. You know, he's just so driven and interested in the adjuncts we've been growing here and playing with the different hops that we've been growing or other Ontario hops that we've procured and the local grains that we have down the road. We're very lucky to have a, you know, a grain distributor in Malter just 4 kilometers away, basically. So he's really enjoyed that and learning a new water profile. So he's been brewing nonstop and literally brewing. I mean, there hasn't been a single misstep in the whole thing. He's been here for 6 months. So however many weeks that is, you know, 24 or something like that, 24 distinct, really interesting, very delicious beers that have been really well received. So we released a lot of different beers and some of it is seasonal. Like we're moving into sap beer season soon, where we're going to make beer out of sap, take out the water, use sap out of our maple trees instead. And it's very unique adjunct, you know, like a wet, it's again, one of my favorite seasons for beer making, like wet hops. It's just, you get it once a year, you can't replicate it in any way. It's impossible. It just purely comes with seasonality and it has a very, very distinct tone to what it presents. No matter what style of beer you make on top of the sap, there is a very distinct tone that comes through with that tree water that you're using in your beer. So that's super interesting. But our goal is to make beers that satisfy, you know, everybody. We between our Golden Ale and our Pilsner, all the way to our IPA, and we've got a bunch of different IPAs coming out. you know, there's something for everybody. Someone who doesn't really care about beer is not a craft beer drinker, to people who are hardcore into it, craft beer bars all the time and very judgmental and super on the Untappd app, that really take it seriously, that are really, you know, like a sommelier or their Cicerones or Cicerones in the making, trying to find, you know, chase that like perfect beer that they're going to buy five cases of, like you would a wine that you find and you fall in love with. You're like, got to buy it now. That vintage is, you know, it's limited. Yeah, yeah. And it's gone, you know, like that's the approach.
Yeah. No, I do think that I've never really understood wine the same. Not that I say that I think that I understand beer, but I've never really, it's too complicated for me. Wine is just like the subtleties are there too much. Like I can't grasp them with beer. At least I can understand when they say this tastes like this, or it you know, I get it. And it seems easier for me for whatever reason. I probably enjoy, I don't know if I just fit in better. I'm not sure. So probably part of the reason why I wanted to have you on here and interview, because it's an interesting world to me. And what usually happens is that I ask so many questions when I hear these situations that then I forget a lot of the components. So now I'm recording it. And so now if I forget, then I can go back and remember, okay, this is what he said. Okay. Yes. All right. And take that back. So thanks for that. Do you, maybe one of my last questions, but just in terms of your goals and your, like, you know, personal goals and where, what, you know, what makes you happy and what you're trying to achieve here with Good Lot? Like what do you see that as being?
Well, Gail and I have been talking a lot about, you know, wanting to make sure we cross country ski every single day. Yeah. You know, we want to strike balance in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got this sort of trifecta of, you know, Mike Brooks and Gail and myself that are really focused on the future of this company and the quality of what we do and what we want to do. But one of the things that, you know, resonates for all three of us is that, you know, life balance as much as possible. And maybe it's a thirst more than ever because of being locked down for so long, but the desire to travel and to go explore other places, you know, in Ontario, across Canada, you know, around the world. And so we want to build a sustainable business. Definitely never intended to take over the world or become a large beer company. I remember when I first modeled out the beer industry, I'm like, okay, perfect. That's as big as we ever need to be. Those 11 people can generate this, have a good life. Hopefully everyone gets 6 weeks off a year. And, you know, that'll be amazing. Now, reality is a little bit different in terms of the intensity and the low margins of the beer industry. But we want to build a sustainable business that is able to continue to protect, you know, the land we're on and take care of these headwaters that we sit on literally through our property and the soil that we care for, and make amazing beer and be a great community partner and community cheerleader for what's going on around here, support, you know, the initiatives in this community. And we say it sometimes that, you know, we do a lot of fundraising with our beer and with the space for our local hospital, our local hospice, and recently our local Meals on Wheels. And it's like, well, that's the hospital we go to when we're sick and we're going to die in that hospice. And Meals on Wheels is going to be delivering our meals to us when we're old. Like, we just got to make sure this is all. So there's a lot of, you know, motivation to, because we expect to be here for the rest of our lives, you know, without a doubt. We love this farm and this space and this community is amazing. The people that we get to hang out with and the people we meet, you know, on a daily basis here are always just are so motivating to do great things, to make them happy. And, you know, I don't know. I'm turning 50 in literally a few weeks. So that's a turning point to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. A reflection point, right?
Well, it is. I mean, I've worked super hard my whole life and I spent most of it as an activist trying to do what I thought was really necessary for future generations. And I am really proud of what we've been able to do here on a shoestring budget with just Gail and I doing this on our own with a baby on your back, you know, turning the soil to start a farm and everything else we've done. And we'd like that to continue. You know, we'd like to think our son would take over the business someday and think of this multi-generational farm that goes 3, 4, 6, you know, generations down the road. who knows what's really going to happen. I mean, zombie apocalypse is happening next, right? So it's anyone's guess. We're all going to be
dealing. Yeah, that's the world we're in. Yeah.
It's probably not the right thing to say. No, the world is going to open up and it's going to be more progressive and more beautiful than ever before. And we're going to cooperate with our neighbors more and get to know them better and be so happy. I've been drinking through this whole interview. I mean, it's like, honestly, I mean,
in terms of communicating with people and telling people the story, what is the best way to kind of follow everything that's going on?
I mean, coming to the farm is the best way to follow what's going on and coming visiting and seeing, you know, getting into the space yourself, which you've seen. But you know, our website is always up to date in terms of beers that are coming out every week and Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, none of which we really think are super awesome for civilization, but they are great ways to share information and some nice images and some critical stuff, I guess, that it's easy way for people to know what's going on.
Yeah.
So that's generally how we communicate, or call us, you know, we're always picking up the phone, answer the phone or get curbside pickup, either Gail or myself or Reina or Dean or Danielle or Mike Brooks will be in the parking lot giving you your beer. So you'll be able to talk to everybody directly and see what's coming down the pipe, you know?
Nice. All right. Okay, great. Well, I mean, I will link to some of that stuff and hopefully introduce a few new people to you guys. It's kind of a rabbit hole when I get into a new brewery, because you just want to see, hey, where's this come from? What are you doing here? Okay, what's the new stuff? Like, whatever. And if you guys have a new beer every week, then that's, never ending. There's always something new and fresh and interesting to try out. So, anyways, I appreciate you being on the podcast and chatting. I definitely learned a few things about the beer industry, and I'm always trying to learn more. So,
well, Greg, it's my pleasure. Thank you for doing this, and thanks for what you've been doing, you know, at Farmer, and just in terms of promoting some of the, I think, these important things. So thanks for taking the time. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot. Thank you so much for listening to that interview. If you want to learn more about Good Lot, I'm going to do some links on the website, lifetimeatwork.com. You can find a little bit more about them and follow their social, and maybe when it's possible, go visit them. It's a cool place where they have a big outdoor bar, kind of small concert venue, almost kind of thing going on with lots of things to buy and participate in and eat and all that. So it's a cool place. Otherwise, stay tuned for some other cool podcasts. And if you ever have an idea or a suggestion for a future guest, please let me know. Go to lifetimeatwork.com and there you can suggest one to me. I'm always open to ideas. And until next time, don't worry, be happy.